Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Port of Harlem Talk Radio, and I'm your host and also publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your question in the comment box. You can also call to listen by dialing on your phone at 516-531-9540. And if you want to also ask a question after you are connected, press 1, and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We're also available on about 10 podcast platforms, and We Talk Productions sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Our first guest today is C.R. Gibbs, and Gibbs is the author and co-author of 6 books and a frequent national and international lecturer on an array of historical topics, and he has appeared several times on the History Channel and French and Belgian television. He is a Port of Harlem contributor, and you can also find his Port of Harlem articles, videos, and podcasts published by other media besides Port of Harlem at portofharlem.net/C. Gibbs. And hopefully you read the, and if you haven't, we'll talk about it until we catch up a little bit, the latest article he contributed to Port of Harlem called Black Oppression Then and Now. It's at the top of our page right now at portofharlem.net, and it will stay there for at least the next month, 2 months, and may not be at the top by then, but it'll still be there. Welcome, CR. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, Brother Wayne. How about yourself?
Well, you know, it's a pleasure to have you on here because you're consistently our best contributor, or one of our best contributors. And I know you're so busy so often, and you're on so many different channels and so many different stations, and so it's good to have you home.
Yes, indeed, brother.
Okay. So my first question, though, is I wonder if there's a historical answer, thought, or theory on the paradox of some people who know we had to fight for the right to vote, but now are against voting, and those we know who had to fight to have the right to have a gun, but support gun control.
In a way, they're kind of linked. We black folk started willing to participate in a political process that they hoped would be fair and open and equal. But the problem was is that they soon learned that it would not be fair, it would not be free, it would not be open, and that there were people who were willing to kill us to keep us from exercising a right guaranteed to us by constitutional amendment. And so more and more of us said, well, look, and I'll give you an example. About 100 years ago in Ocoee, Florida, a town about 12 miles outside of Orlando, brother showed up to vote, which he was supposed to be able to legally do. He talked to a judge and just said, well, just go on back. You can vote. Well, brother took his gun with him the second time, and
okay.
He thought that was going to make a difference. The problem was is that the folk that met him at the polling place had more guns than he did, and he was lynched. But the point is that when we have attempted to exercise, again, our constitutionally granted rights, we have often been met with brutal force. There have been people who stood in our way 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and who stand in our way now to prevent us from voting. And we've used the gun, we've used everything in our ammunition belt to try and fight the way. The problem is that with many young people, and we have to understand that young people see what's going on from a different place than older folk. For young people, they're looking at now, and now don't look so good. And when you don't know the history that comes along with it, as many of the elders do, you're impatient and think that you were the first to do something, when in fact this is a long battle, it is a generational battle, and we have been fighting for our rights for a very long time.
Yeah, I can understand that perfectly. Let me break. But let me break this into two. And what I need to break into two is that All the time we use that argument that younger people don't know their history and they don't know the struggle to vote, so they don't feel the need to vote. And I'm with you on that one. But I had to ask myself, why am I a person, and this is after reading your article too, and why am I a person who's for gun control? And yet I know that we also had to fight for the right to carry a gun, just like we had to fight for the right to vote.
It is one of those.
Go ahead.
I got you. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those American conundrums. We struggle, and we find ourselves falling into the contradictions in those spaces in American society where we'd like to be able to ignore the inconsistencies, the dichotomies, but we cannot because race always, pardon the expression, trumps everything else. And we've got to fight for our communities. We have the right to self-defend ourselves. So what we must demonstrate, and the knowledge of the past helps do that, is that as bad as it is today, there has been some limited progress. Now, the mistake is how it's taught in the schools. In the schools, it's taught as though beginning in the 1950s with the Civil Rights Movement, Dr. King came along like a wizard with a star on a stick and touched people, and man, they just went 180 degrees overnight, when that's not true. Civil rights progress has never been quick. It's never been easy. It's never been linear. On a good day, it's three steps forward and two steps back. And
okay,
so we have to – I'm sorry.
So you're saying it's not unusual for a person like me to struggle with the idea that I know that I need to vote because my ancestors had to fight for the right to vote, but at the same time I can hold back and say, well, I'm not so sure about have everyone having a gun, even though I know that my ancestors had to fight for a gun.
If everybody has a gun, we run the risk of still being outgunned. And so we're to some extent, we're back where we started. So each of us has to arrive at a medium where we recognize that in situations we should have the right to have a gun when necessary, and we're not being less a citizen if we carry one. Lord knows our enemies don't feel less a citizen because they carry one. But understand that the weight of the law is unequal. And so if we get caught, we can't expect the same protections. The Philando Castile shooting. I mean, here's a man, he got his paperwork with him. He's got a gun. He is still shot by the police. So it is always riskier for us to pursue our rights in any arena. And this is what our knowledge of history reminds us, that yeah, we want to carry our gun. We want to carry it open. We want to carry it on our belt. We want to carry it in a bag with us. But understand that the weight of law enforcement always has us run an unequal risk.
Okay, I'm still with you on that. But if a person mm-hmm. came to me today and said, well, Wayne, you know, you have to be pro-gun, just like you are pro-vote, what defense do I have when I know, like you do, that in both cases, our ancestors had to fight for both of them? But I'm saying, hey, but when it comes to gun control, comes to carrying a gun, I'm not so sure I want to do that one. But I am all for voting.
And this is an issue that's still evolving. After 200 years and the Second Amendment, this is an issue that is still evolving. What I would say is that we have to vote for the right for equal gun laws and for the equal enforcement of gun laws. Until that happens, everyone has to make this decision for himself. Is your carrying a gun going to subject you to greater or lesser cost in a racist law enforcement system? And if you feel you must still do it, then do it. If you're in a part of the country where a relative of mine was recently nearly run off the road in South Carolina, he was packing. He had his stuff with him, but he knew that it was more important for him to get home get off that deserted stretch of highway than to engage in a running gun battle with some fool who has a gun rack in his pickup truck, because he understood that when the cops showed up, 9 times out of 10, he would receive the tougher end of the stick. That is, again, that is a conundrum. It is a riddle. It is a paradox in American society that when we assume, when we pursue the same laws as everybody else, the outcomes are anything but equal.
Well, in that case, I can say that the paradox of me is that I have to figure out, okay, I guess I'm still against gun control. I mean, for gun control, despite knowing the history, and I have to deal with that. And I guess part of it is I have to deal with the weight of history as well.
I think we're wise to consider not only the weight of the past, but the weight of the present. Let's say stand your ground. In stand your ground states, that doesn't seem to protect black folk the same way it protects white folks. Just to be honest
with
you, it doesn't seem to get us quite there. There was a well-known case of an African-American woman in a southern state. She claimed stand your ground. They sent the sister to jail anyway. Whereas there have been a number of whites who've been able to, policemen and non-policemen, who have been able to successfully use that claim and not serve any time. So when we have every right to pursue the right to bear arms, but just understand that in the pursuit and attainment of those rights, the actual accomplishing of the law may fall unequally on us. So just like with every other thing we do in American society, there is an extra super added risk.
Exactly. That one I'll have to continue to live with. One of our readers, you mentioned South Carolina, but he's from North Carolina. His name is James Durant. He asks, has voter suppression against people of color significantly increased during the Trump presidential term?
Yes. What we see is that the Republicans are bound and determined to use every modern trick in their arsenal to keep us from voting. And that ranges from changing polling stations, changing times, changing locations, to going back. And I mean, for several years, Republicans at the state level continue to institute new barriers to voting. And while they claim this is being done in the name of ballot to combat ballot insecurity, they seem to be concerned more about voters in black neighborhoods than they do in the general public. So, for example, they were able to strike down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act in 2013. And once that protection fell, a range of states, north, south, east, and west, began a rush to institute voter ID bills and all these kinds of things that sought to make it more difficult for black folk to vote. So it has increased. It always had. There was a time, and I had to remind a young brother of this the other day, when Democrats practiced voter suppression when black folks were predominantly Republican. And in those years, during the period of Republican Reconstruction and the nadir, which is the period right after Reconstruction, coming down into the beginning of the modern civil rights movement, of course, the night riders and cross burnings and outright murder to keep us from the polls. But this 20th century brand and 21st century brand has certainly increased under the Trump administration.
And what was the name of what? How did you name the period after Reconstruction?
The nadir, N-A-D-I-R. This is a period given to the era right after Reconstruction and coming into the 20th century. The nadir is the lowest point, the low point. And for us, that for black people, that was certainly the case. Many stories stop when 1877, with the withdrawal of federal troops from the South, but the removal of what little protection they provided signaled an era of wanton murder, torture, and rape to keep us from exercising our rights. And so I've recently developed a new lecture called Bright Promise, Bitter Betrayal that talks about that forgotten period, which lasted, again, from about 1877 down into the beginning of the modern civil rights movement and affected us into women were supposed to have the vote 1920. But guess what? Well, not all women. White women may have had the constitutional right to vote, but the reality was is that black women could not vote. And black men, having been given the right to vote by the 15th Amendment in 1870, still could not safely vote in many parts of the United States.
Well, I appreciate, too, you explaining the word Nader. I had never heard that before. I have to look that up. But
Rayford Logan, Rayford Logan popularized, he may have, in fact, invented the term to cover that particular political period. And for the listeners, Rayford Logan, a famed Howard University historian.
I appreciate that. We have a call or a listener on the line on who may also want to ask a question. If that person or persons want to ask a question, just dial 1 or punch in 1. And let us know that you also want to join the conversation, but you're welcome to just listen. And my other question is about going back to your article, Black Voter Suppression Then and Now. You mentioned Yunita Blackwell, one of the founders of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and the first female African-American mayor in Mississippi. And what you wrote in particular, you said Yunita Blackwell, one of the gallant founders of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, said that at first she did not know blacks actually had the right to vote in her state. Okay, often when people speak of a person from that period of situation, they speak of Fannie Lou Hamer. Just to get a better sense of how you decided to craft this story and your stories in general, how did you choose her name and her story out of all the people you could have chosen?
Yunita Blackwell is one of those people who deserves for all of the absolute percolating hell she caught in trying to vote. For example, the cops watched her, and if she was inches over her parking space, she would get a ticket. Inches. So there was harassment, obviously harassment when she had formally attempted to vote. But even on an everyday basis, there was always something to remind her from the very supposed guardians who were there supposedly in the state of Mississippi to protect and serve everyone, but black people could not expect equal protection under the law. And there's a very famous picture of her testifying at a hearing and sitting next to Fannie Lou Hamer, but no one knows about Yunita. And we just lost Yunita Blackwell this past May, I believe it was. So she was able to be a beacon for generations of people that wanted to know the true story of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and the remarkably little-known role of black women in the continuing fight for the vote. And I always like to concentrate on people that are not well known, except I never anticipated, Brother Wayne, that I just listened to an actress who says she wants to play one of the leaders of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, but she kept saying Fannie Lou Hamer. And she said it 3 times in a row. So I'm hoping someone, pulled the sister aside before she left the studio and said, "No, it ain't Hamer, it's Fannie Lou Hamer." But her partner in this gallant crusade was Yunita Blackwell, whom far fewer people have heard of, but she shared the indignities, the dangers of along with Fannie Lou Hamer. So that's why I chose her. Because we get tired, some of us, of hearing about the same people time after time after time.
No, I'm glad you said the last sentence, because I was going to say that I appreciate the biography, but I think that's what I appreciate most about your articles, is that you always find these people that we don't hear about every day, as if someone is producing a 30-minute commercial that we had to see every TV show. And
yeah.
So, and I remember her from the days of reading Jet. But after that, I just totally forgot who she was until
mm-hmm.
I saw the name of the article.
And it comes from going into the schools. You know, I've had until recently, a matter of fact, as recently as this past February, I spent a couple of days at Dunbar
high school in D.C.
At Dunbar High School in D.C. I was asked to come in by a very committed young black teacher. When he asked his students, he said, "Do y'all know anything about ancient African empires?" And they said, "We ain't never heard of an ancient African empire." Apparently, the only African empire they'd ever heard of was Wakanda. So, you know, they did not know of an actual existing African empire. And so he asked me to come in, and I spent a couple of days talking to the young people because it is critical. We make assumptions about what our kids who have to carry this bad law know, and we it is dangerous to assume that which has not been that they know that which has not been taught them. If it wasn't taught to us, the chances are it ain't, emphasis on ain't, being taught to them.
I got you. I looked it up. Yeah, Ms. Blackwell died May 13th in 2019, and you know, I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know what happened to our remembering her death. But moving on to my next question, you also wrote that before his assassination, President Lincoln had come around to the idea that a limited number of blacks might be eligible to vote. When I read that, my first thought was, do you think we overplay Lincoln as being some great emancipator?
One quick story. I was a guide for a group of South African businessmen when they came to D.C. I met them at the old Statler Hilton Hotel right on 16th, up from Black Lives Matter Plaza, as it turns out, if we'd only known. And I said, where do you brothers and sisters want to go? We want to go to the Lincoln Memorial because Lincoln was a great guy. I said, well, let me talk to y'all on the way to the memorial. I said, because, you know, we tend to over. This is a man who said that I am not an abolitionist. And in the debates between himself and Stephen Douglas, he said, as long as there must be a position of superior and inferior, I, as much as any man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to members of the white Douglas at the consecration of the Lincoln Memorial, said that Lincoln was neither our man nor our model. And because Lincoln had been very reluctant, very slow, to move toward the concept of black freedom. In fact, he had to pull a couple of his generals back, emancipation edicts that they signed back, because he was trying to keep the lid on this until he could do no more. And finally, he said, if I could save the nation half slave and half free, or if I could save the nation and free, I would do it. So we do tend to overplay him a bit.
Sometimes I wonder if it's just a bit, if it's just way too much, especially when you go into black communities, you see a Lincoln High School or Lincoln Elementary School, and I'm like, I don't even know if I want that to be there anymore either. I mean, not that he's a bad person, but he's definitely, in my opinion anymore, is not as much as I was taught that he was.
Well, it could be said, as he said of one of his generals, that Lincoln had the slows when it come to racial advancement. And he criticized one of the generals for being slow on the battlefield, where he was slow on the racial battlefield. And to give you an example, we spend so much time eulogizing Lincoln when we should stop for Henry Wilson, who came in, he was a white guy born into grinding poverty in New Hampshire. He was so poor, his daddy offered to change his name in honor of any rich white man that would take him on as a protege.
Gotcha.
And so that may have been why he identified with black people. He is really the spark plug behind DC emancipation. Not only is he the spark plug behind DC emancipation, or one of the, certainly as much as Lincoln ever was, and he also authored the laws to do away with the black codes in the nation's capital. Now, the elders at the time knew what he had done and who he was, but he has been forgotten. And he died in the U.S. Capitol shortly after completing a major work called The Rise and Fall of the Slave Power. And yet, you know, there's no school named after him in D.C.
So,
and he was vice president
or,
and a senator.
So was he a representative, a senator, or what? Or did I just miss that?
He was one of President Grant's vice presidents. He had two. He had Schuyler Colfax and Henry Wilson. And he was a senator from New Hampshire. They called him the Natick Cobbler because he was apprenticed to making shoes. He learned how to make shoes.
Okay, so he was a vice president and a senator.
Yeah, Henry Wilson. Henry, and died in the U.S. Capitol building.
So we have to look more into him. And how do you view Thaddeus Stevens as being compared to Henry Wilson?
Henry Wilson was a contemporary of Thaddeus Stevens. These were men who, because of what was inside them, made them stand out in their advocacy of black causes and of the black condition, and their desire to alleviate this. And so if we had to put in a favorite five, my favorite five, Lincoln would be number six in my favorite five. and so, you know, there would be Thaddeus Stevens and Henry Wilson and Charles Sumner and John Brown. These are folk that, I mean, Charles Sumner is beaten, again, in the U.S. Capitol, beaten nearly unconscious by Preston Brooks. Preston Brooks caned him in the presence of other members of Congress, but that did not stop him from advocating for black advancement. I mean, these are people that paid a price for hanging out with black folk. And at Henry Wilson's gravesite, none of the stuff that he did for black people is mentioned anywhere on his sepulcher. So these are people who we need to know more about instead of constantly leaning on old Abe Lincoln.
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely going to have to spend some time learning more about Senator and Vice President Henry Wilson. But moving back to present times, in your opinion, what is the most blatant act of current voter suppression?
There's so much to choose from. In some ways, it kind of boggles the mind. There are, for example, California authorities have launched an investigation into unauthorized fake ballot boxes put out by the Republican Party in the state of California in at least three counties.
Yes,
now,
I mean that's
extraordinary. Who would do some stuff like that and then try to claim it was legal? You know, it's bad enough, like I said earlier, that they want to keep us from curbside voting in Alabama. They block counties from offering curbside voting. In Texas, you know, we got over 100 counties. They want to have one box in each county. You know, in Harris County, where Dallas is, I think I put this in the article. That is completely inadequate, purposefully inadequate. North Carolina, well, we just, for some reason, we seem to be rejecting primarily black voters for some odd reason. But we don't know why. So we have a lot to choose from, and at the same time, never has it been more important that we vote, not only for president and vice president, as I said in the history of voter suppression piece in Port of Harlem, but we also have what would be called down ballot measures if you're repulsed by presidential politics, remember you're also voting on stuff that affects you at your front door or your backyard. Trash collection, street lights, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about people saying things that just blow your mind. One of the things that blows my mind is on some Facebook pages, people claim that they don't like Biden and they're going to vote down ballot. And it makes me wonder, hopefully, that when they saw this last Supreme Court fight, that they understand the importance of voting the whole ballot and not just down ballot. But I don't know. I don't have much hope on that because these people are supposed to pass high school, and in high school they should be taught basic civics. So I'm not
many jurisdictions don't teach civics anymore, just like they don't teach geography. And so some of these folks can't find their way to the polling place. At least that's the way it would seem to be. I mean, let me just one another dirty tactic that came to mind. They just busted two guys for robocalls. This is in Ohio. Two men were indicted with false warnings of arrest and debt collection and forced vaccination. I mean, this is the kind of crazy stuff that minority voters in Ohio were facing by two guys who were finally busted by the police.
Is this the one that we have pictures of people's homes too?
No, that's another one. They're filming people. They're filming their houses. They're filming them at the polling place. All of this, and even though Judge Amy Coney Barrett didn't seem to be familiar with the section of the U.S. Code that makes intimidation at the polling place illegal, it is a violation of federal law to intimidate folks at the polling place. It is illegal.
Yeah, well, the one that got me the most is in Florida because I don't know why, but whatever reason I watched it and read about it, and that's when the voters themselves said that if you had committed a crime and you got out, that you can get your voting rights back, and I assumed that was going to mean immediately. I mean, I saw no time clause inside the discussion before the voters voted. And then once they passed it, the legislature come back and says, yes, you can do it, but only after you pay these debts. And I was thinking, that's really bizarre, because, you know, oftentimes when people go to jail, it's because they have no money. Or even if you had some money, you don't have any once you get in jail because you pay so much for lawyer fees, and then you can't make any money because you're in jail. But then to ask someone to pay back the money before they can vote seemed kind of bizarre. That's the one that got to me the most.
Well, this is why it amounts, as I said in the article, quoting Congresswoman Val Demings from Florida, that this amounts to a new kind of poll tax. Because
yeah,
you have
to
pay. Yeah, you have to pay to get the right to exercise your right to vote. I'm glad that Michael Bloomberg and other people, Well Hill, have set up an organization to pay off at least some of those fines. But it is a dastardly thing that the governor of Florida was doing. But again, let's see. He's not a Democrat.
No.
He is a rabid pro-Trumper. And so when the caller asked about how these things are increasing, all you have to do, and understand that most of this is concentrated, I don't think it's by accident, Brother Wayne, in the former states of the Confederacy.
Exactly. And, you know, with those of us living in D.C., I would love to share with people who live, even a sister in Arkansas, we was chatting online, and I was trying to tell her she was not wanting to vote for Joyce Elliott, the black woman who wants to make history in Arkansas. And I was trying to explain to her, her opponent got an F from the NAACP. But the most important thing, I said, I live in D.C. Half the rights you want, I have already. And one of those examples is that the D.C. government sent me my ballot. I didn't have to ask for one. And I've already gotten three calls already to remind me to vote and how to vote. And, you know, I wish people could see the distinction between a city like D.C. or a future state of D.C. and how these other places behave. And I think they'll be amazed on the differences. And yet we all live in the same country.
This
That's
is why
my,
we can't. No. You raise up a valid point. That this is why we can't embrace these concepts about originalism or textualism in the Constitution. This is why we can't salute the flag of full state sovereignty, because the states have treated black folk, by and large, like crap. Historically, they have been in the leadership of denying our rights or making it much more difficult to exercise our rights. We've had to insist on federal control of many of our basic civic functions because the states would not allow us to practice fairly and equally. So, but yes, it's the truth. Southern states are more likely to place restrictions on voting by mail, whether it's Texas, Louisiana, Tennessee. Of course, Indiana's up in the mix too.
Oh yeah, for sure. Indiana has a D in one report on voter access, and yeah, I had to get my mother her ballot. She's in the state, and the things I had to go through were a little antiquated, but it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. But it was a bit antiquated. But moving on to our talking to these people currently about these historical issues in your daily life, how do you handle people with historically inaccurate information or insensitivity?
I pray for them.
Okay.
I have found oftentimes that, what is the saying, often wrong, but never in doubt. There are people who just don't have it, but they have, even when you attempt to correct them, they're never going to admit to being wrong. They're constitutionally, personally, genetically incapable of admitting that they don't know. So even though somebody thought I was worthy enough to come and talk to them about a particular aspect of our history or our current situation, that's not enough for them. And so I have learned that I'm better off with the folk that have a question and will turn slightly in my direction as to those folks that keep their backs to me.
Gotcha. I know one guy, Peter Billy, in particular, was having, he told, I don't think you probably know Peter, he told me once that he's getting too old to argue with people.
You lose patience. Peter is a magnificent scholar and an all-around good brother. I take my hat off and genuflect in front of him for his many achievements. But I find as I get older, you don't waste time arguing. Well, I was going to use an F word, but with two O's and an L and an S, you just don't waste your time with people who the ignorance is not a path to better knowledge, but it is a sliding board into deeper ignorance. So I don't, I'm not going to grab anybody and tell them you're wrong. But if I have an opportunity, if they indicate a question, then there's that's a chance for me to shed a little light.
Yeah, and for those who say that, they're being insensitive, and that's where I felt at first when Peter told me that, then I had to realize this man's been around for so long, and he's been there. He wasn't reading these things. He was there. But some of the things that he was talking about, he was there, and he was a journalist. And he, like yourself, he spends time to research, and so it becomes very difficult, I can assume, to speak from your perspective, to actually do all his reading, and then have someone who has read nothing to tell you that you're wrong. It's like, okay, you want to pick up a book?
Remember, and I don't actually, Brother Wayne, I'm not sure I've mentioned this to you, but I've met some young brothers recently who tell me they stopped reading.
Okay.
And so one young brother, and this was outside of the Thurgood Marshall building in Shaw, I said, well, where do you get your information? Oh, I get it from people like you. I said, well, brother, that part's well and good, but you have to own the information that comes out of your mouth. You have to put the seat of your pants to the seat of the chair and inculcate yourself with this information. You just can't, I'm not walking you to that. That's why the YouTube degree can be a little bit shaky, because all you've done is you've heard somebody else tell you something, but if you're questioned deeply about it, you got no depth.
Yeah.
Because you don't know any more than just what you've heard. In other words, you may be a mile wide, but you're only an inch deep.
Gotcha. And on that tip, I will share with people that you even advised me when I asked you about a movie, a historical movie, and you told me if you wanted to know history, it's best not to watch a movie. It's best for you to go do your own research.
Well, hey, I mean.
And I learned to quit asking you that question.
Well, it's just that even today, there are movies in which black people had prominent. I love westerns. I'm a relic of my time. I love westerns, but there are days when I pull out what little hair I have left because specific events that occurred and involved black people, and yet black folk are never shown, and that's all the way up to and including today. And so it makes you wonder, well, what is it? The people didn't read any, they didn't ask themselves with any black people, or is it because they were raised on a diet of white movies and never thought to ask the question if black people actually participated in this historical period?
Okay, let me sneak one more question in our last 3 minutes. During the first Reconstruction was between 1863 and 1877. It lasted for about 14 years. It took 70 years for us to get to the second Reconstruction, which was about between 1946 and 1963, and that lasted for about 17 years. Do you consider the Obama years the third Reconstruction?
I think that the Obama years were, in that case, that was even shorter. Because
exactly.
we had 8 years that confused us and made us think this country was further along than it ultimately turned out to be. And I think that we had much of a better understanding after the first two Reconstructions than we did after. I mean, remember, there were people talking about post-black. I'm now post-black. I'm now post-race. No, you ain't. You never were. And it took what came after the Obama years, the era of Obama, to make black folk wake up to the fact that we ain't far along the road as we think we are.
Okay. So do you think we're going to have – so this is really wasn't a full Reconstruction or even a Reconstruction?
No, it was not. In my judgment, no. It was too short. It was too short.
Okay.
The Obama – I would not call it that, certainly not for the length of time it lasts, and given that people are frantically scrubbing out any evidence that of anything that the Obama administration did of any lasting import, it was hard to scrape some of the things out, certainly from the first Reconstruction and a few things from the second Reconstruction. But the Obama years, if anything, and what came after reminds us that we must be vigilant about our history, because laws can be taken off the books, but our knowledge of the history we must keep in our hearts and minds and teach it to our children, whether it's in school or in church or in the home.
Okay. So in our last 2 minutes, you have a Zoom event tomorrow. What is that about? And for those who want to know the details, you can go to porterpolum.net, and then the current issue under activities, you will find it under culture. And so you want to remember the dates, the time, et cetera. It's online. It's called Awesome Glory, Great Black Women Past and Present. What is that going to be about?
I stretch it from the pyramids and palaces of ancient and medieval Africa to the sun-kissed shores of Central and South America before we get to the U.S. of A. It is an extraordinary look at the accomplishments of women of African descent all over the world and throughout time.
And include women from South and Central America?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
oh, that's good,
yeah.
Because oftentimes they're overlooked as if they don't exist.
And that's part of the problem. When they're more Afro-Latinos than there are African-Americans. So, we got it. We if if I had to grab some young folk and say, and they say, what do we need to study? We need to study Africa. We need to study slavery. We need to study race. We need to study the diaspora. We need to study African diaspora as well, where black folk are around the world, where they have been, and what they've done all the way around the globe.
Okay, so before we go, I just want to remind people that you can go to porterhollum.net, Google C.R. Gibbs on our website, and you'll get to his page, where, or even if you go outside of our page and Google C.R. Gibbs, you can get to his page, which has a whole list of his articles that are in Port of Harlem and in other publications, his videos, and his podcast. So, C.R., thanks for your time. I appreciate it. And I
thank you, Brother Wayne, for giving me this marvelous opportunity to share with your audience.
Well, thank you for your conversation. You know, I appreciate that greatly, and I always appreciate your articles. And, you know, always when I finish talking to you, that means I have to go look something up. So thanks so much
well,
for your
you,
time.
Brother. All right.
Take care. Take care.
Take care. Goodbye.
Bye. Okay, coming up next, we have Mercer. How are you doing today?
I'm well. How are you, Wayne?
Pretty good. Thanks for coming on. And Mercer Red Cross is our next guest. And if you're listening via the internet, you can type your questions in the comment box. You can also call to listen by dialing on your phone at 516-531-9040. Or yeah, 99540. If you want to ask a question after you're connected, press 1 and please be quiet. Mercer, as you may know or you may not know, he's with the Philadelphia International Art Expo, and it's been going on since 1985. So it's his 35th year, and I'm glad that you all are going virtual. So my first question to you, I know you've been conducting this expo since 1985, as I mentioned, but is this your first virtual show?
Yes, it is. This is our first year of doing a virtual show. The expo started in 1985. The first one we did was at a Marriott hotel. We had 1,000 square feet, and about 900 people came to it, 900 attendees. Over the years, the expo grew, and at one point, it was the largest African-American art expo in the nation. It was 3 days. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and at its height, we clocked in about 42,000 people. And
yeah, at least twice
of course,
I was one of those 42,000 people.
Yes, you were, and I certainly appreciate, you know, you participating, coming up from D.C. to the show. But a lot has happened over 35 years, and mainly the internet. The premise of the show initially was that people would come into our gallery, because we've also had a gallery for 35 years, and people would come into the gallery and they would buy artwork by Ernie Barnes, Romare Bearden, Jacob Lawrence, whomever, Cal Massey. And at some point they would say, well, where is Ernie Barnes? Where is Cal Massey? You know, are these real people? So the expo was going along, but at some point we decided, let's bring these people in from wherever they are around the country and bring them in so they can meet our customers one-on-one. And that was the premise of the expo, and I think that's why it grew geometrically during that time. But now, of course, people can go on the internet and see interviews with Charles Bibbs and these contemporary artists, or they can listen to podcasts like this. So we decided this year, and also because my grandkids are in it, you know, and they're 20-something, and so
okay.
We decided to go virtual this year, and that's why we're doing it. And we're excited about it. We are very excited about it.
Yeah, I was really excited about looking at your site, because so many of our customers and advertisers and clients and contacts have gone virtual this year. We've done at least 2 different articles on their going virtual. And so in the process, I have to go to this site and check it out. And sometimes I'm a bit confused. On yours, there was no confusion whatsoever. In fact, I was about to write your email, and then I said, oh, there's the answer right there. So I'm looking
forward to
participating and looking more at your site, because it was so easy to navigate. So I'm going to ask you, what was your biggest challenge to go from having a physical event to having a virtual event? and making it easy for people like myself to navigate your website?
Well, first of all, you've got to bring in young people, younger people. I mean, I'm a baby boomer, you know, I'm 72 years old. I was part of that baby boomer generation. And when we talk about contemporary African-American art, especially the customer that we went after during all those years, the black baby boomers really, in our minds, the people who made what we call the golden age of African-American art, which was from 1985 to 2005. And these are baby boomers. They were born between 1946 and 1964. Almost forgot. You know, we grew up under the effects of Jim Crow South. We had Afro hairdos. We wore the dashikis. A lot of us went to black colleges. We marched for civil rights. We read the autobiography of Malcolm X. And then we went out into the workforce. And we were probably the first black generation that had disposable income. And because we were so culturally aware, we decided to take some of that disposable income and support black art and black artists. So I'm saying that. So as we came along during those years, from 1985 to 2005, in essence, we knew where the bodies were buried. We went after the baby boomers. We knew where they were, and they came in droves to the show. We were very, very excited about that. Well, that generation's getting older, okay? They're downsizing. They're moving from maybe the big house to the condo. And so, therefore, we needed to go after a younger audience.
And
talking to my grandkids and so forth, they said, you've got to go virtual. So we decided to go virtual. And they are 22, 24, and 27, and they really have a handle on how to do this. So that's how we made that transition. And these are actually young folks that were at every expo. They grew up at the expo, so they're familiar
with
it.
But how hard was it for you to go? I mean, first, the African American Genealogical Society, when they went from a face-to-face convention to an online convention,
mm-hmm.
one of the problems they had is that some of their presenters didn't know how to work in the virtual world.
Yeah.
So they had to get new ones. Then they ran into the problem of schools going back online. So they lost some of their technical expertise.
But did you have
any problems like that?
Well, you know, this would be the first one we're doing. We were having meetings every other night. And the idea is that, yes, you have to take these black baby boomers and sort of retrain them, but let them know that we're going from the physical world to the virtual world. And, it's just a work in progress. It's just like when we started the Expo in 1985. We told people to come to a hotel room, we're going to have artwork there. And they came, and over time it grew. You know, our motto has always been we have to transform first and then transact. So we're figuring these first couple of years of this virtual expo, it's going to take a while for us to get the bugs out of it and for us also to connect with our old customers and bring them up to it and also to get the younger people in. But we don't know. I mean, it's November 12th through the 15th. We're hoping we're not going to have any snags, but of course, you know, these things happen. Bringing young people in, and especially people who have been in the arts and been a part of the expo, I think pushes us down the road a little further than maybe most folks may get to. They at least know the art, they know the expo, they know how it works. Now we're taking the model that we did for the physical and now trying to make it work in the virtual world.
I think that when you have these meetings every other day, that you know you've been having some obstacles, but by having younger people much more involved than say maybe some others had, your road to transformation hasn't been as challenging as it could have been.
Yeah, that's true. And the acid test is, of course, when you actually do the event. You know, you plan, and you hope that it works. And in the meeting, the last meeting that we had maybe 10 people in the room. Six of them were baby boomers who had been to the show, and these are professional people who helped us One person in there has been with us 30 years. And then you got four or five younger people. And so they're sort of saying to us, this is how I think it should work. And then we're saying to them, well, this is how we did it in the physical world. Is that going to work? We're just sort of going back and forth. You almost have two separate generations. And the older people are in their late 60s or 70s. And the younger people in their 20s. So there's like two generations in the middle there. But one thing they all have in common is that they all have grown up with the Expo. They know the Expo. And from there, we're just going to, you know, we're going to work it as hard as we can and keep our fingers crossed and see if we can. Also, you have to keep in mind, Wayne, that, you know, we're an art community. You know, this is an art gallery. So people have a tendency to give us a little more slack, if you would, in terms of, okay, that was done very artistically. You need to tie it down a little. And I think they may be a little more forgiving than if you're doing maybe a scientific something. You know, I don't know. We'll see. You know, I'll talk to you after the 15th, and we'll see.
Well, it seems like one big key compared to the other four or five people we've talked to about this particular issue is that you all had the younger generation, the older generation working together, which sounds superior. But first, let me go on to the next question, is that a part of the Art Expo is a State of African-American Art meeting, which is on Saturday, November 14th at 3 p.m. I think that's a Zoom meeting, and you correct me if I'm incorrect. And if it is a Zoom or not a Zoom, what should I expect out of it?
Okay. It is a Zoom meeting. It is.
Okay.
People are registering for the meeting. It's Saturday, November the 14th. It's from 3 to 5 p.m. And we have a panel. We've assembled a panel. And the moderator's from Philadelphia. One of the artists is from Texas. Two other artists are actually in Senegal, and they're going to be a part of the meeting as well. Another young lady is from Oakland, California. So we're putting this panel together of artists. They're not just African-American artists that are working here in this country, but also we have two or three artists that are going to be part of that are in Africa and the work that they're doing over there. We have a number of celebrity guests that are going to pop in from time to time. Clifton Davis, if you guys remember Clifton Davis, he was on That's My Mama, and he wrote songs and everything else, but he's coming in to add to the conversation. And we have some other people that are going to come in periodically to participate and contribute in the State of African American Art. Now, of course, with all this happening with the election and everything else, we're hoping that it's not just talking about art and African American art, but art and society, how artists look at what's happening in society and render things, how art influences the community and a community influences the art. And one of the pieces that we're using this year in our promo is a piece that's called Our Time Has Come, and it's by Ted Ellis. He's from Texas. And in the piece, you see a number of young people with their arms up, their fists raised. They have masks on. And, of course, in their slogans like Black Lives Matter, We Can't Breathe, Justice for George, and so forth. So we also want to explore that. How artists are affected by what's happening in the community and vice versa. So we're really excited about that. It's from 3 to 5. It's free. All of our events are always free. So it's free to come in. And we encourage people, they can go to our site, octobergallery.com, and they'll see the link where they can register for the event.
Yeah, if anybody forget, you can always go to portofharlem.net. And even, I believe, on our description here, you'll see the link to October Gallery. So either way that you find it on portofharlem.net, or you remember the October Gallery is it octobergallery.net?
No, octobergallery.com.
Okay, .com. Either way, whether you go to our site or Google it, you'll find it at least on lots of our pages, however you get to our page. And you can click on that. And it's very clear. One thing I love about your site is right in the middle, there's a video that gives you instructions on how to participate.
Yeah. That was one of that's the first thing that we the committee came up with. Let's put a video up there so people can see it. and then from there they can navigate down from there. And I certainly appreciate all the help that your community, Port of Harlem, has contributed and helped us in this endeavor. And it's good. It's good when we work together like this, and we appreciate it very much.
Okay, now last 5 seconds, we want to thank you so much, Mercer Red Cross. The Philadelphia International Art Expo is November 12th, which is a Thursday, to Sunday, November 15th, and you're listening to Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Thank you so much for listening, and you can go to portofharlem.net, go to the top menu and click on Port of Harlem Talk Radio and get this and other past shows. We're also on like 10 different podcasts. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Mercer. I appreciate it. I'll be at least the talk, and I'm definitely going to check out this site. I appreciate it.
Fine. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
Mm-hmm.